Welcome to the Franziska Show podcast on JewishCoffeeHouse.com, the show where I give a voice to Jewish issues, topics, and people. I'm Franziska Frady, your host. Welcome back to the show. This is a Jewish Coffeehouse podcast, so make sure to check out the other podcasts on the network. If you'd like to advertise on this show, please do reach out. This week is young, but I already released my new Purim song, which is called My Voice, and is part of the series, the album I'm working on in English of women in Tanakh. I'm the first person. The song is about Esther. Someone reached out to me asking me to do a performance and run their dance Purim Chagiga in a few weeks. So I'm really interested in taking her up on this opportunity. But I was also thinking if I do prep some new music remixes for Purim, I would love to share it at least one more time with another group of girls. If you are in charge of high school programming and you're looking for an entertainer or a DJ, please reach out. I don't think we need a disclaimer for this podcast because Menachem Hoida will give us all the disclaimers we need. And without any further ado, here we go. Menachem Hoida, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
We start every show with a little religious and professional background. So before we go into our topic, can you please tell us about your upbringing, religiously speaking, and then we'll go into how you got into the field that you practice in today.
So I grew up in Michigan. I went to elementary school here. I then was in yeshiva in Tel's Yeshiva in Chicago. Also spent a year in Belmar Yeshiva near Lakewood, and also in Eretz Yisrael. I spent a few months by Ritzav Lev's yeshiva. My parents got divorced shortly before I started yeshiva, and so my high school experience was filled with a lot of depression and some chaos, and that led to a little bit of a rocky yeshiva experience, which ended a lot earlier than I wanted it to, or than I anticipated. And so towards the end of 12th grade, I was no longer in yeshiva, and I came back here to Detroit. After that, I received my GED and started in community college and discovered that I was really interested in psychology. I was actually taking an intro to psychology class during the fall semester of 2001. So that's when, so like 9/11 happened, like the third day of class or something like that. And it really made me interested in understanding people and eventually understanding trauma. I got my bachelor's degree in social work after a little while and started working with at-risk youth through Jewish Family Service here in Michigan, Metro Detroit. I also did work in the schools at that time, child abuse prevention work, a lot of different things. My role there at JFS at the time was really helping bridge any gaps that existed between the firm community and Jewish Family Service. So that took on different forms at different points. I then left JFS to do some more clinical work and then started doing training for the local community mental health agency. And as a trainer in community mental health, one of the trainings they asked me to start doing was ASSIST, which is a suicide intervention training, a two-day suicide intervention training. After that, I became a Safe Talk trainer, which is a half-day suicide alertness training. And it really brought me into doing this work of education around issues of suicide and suicide prevention and suicide awareness. I also do training for CIT, which is the work that we do in community mental health with law enforcement to help them understand better how to respond to crises. So CIT is a week-long curriculum that law enforcement take to better respond to crisis, to mental health crises. And 2 hours of that week long is about suicide. And I do those 2 hours here in Oakland County. A lot of that work in terms of doing suicide education, and then also obviously doing that in my clinical work as well, has made this an issue that I'm very passionate about.
Thank you for that. When I reached out to cover this topic and have you on, you said, what's my goal? We can go into two different directions here. So can you tell us what those two directions are? And hopefully we'll be able to go into both.
So now I have to remember what I had in mind back then. So when we talk about suicide, right, there are questions about, I use three different trends in my little run up there. And I use suicide awareness, suicide alertness, and suicide intervention. So suicide awareness is understanding what are the statistics around suicide? What does suicide look like? Sort of informational education about suicide. There is also, in addition to that, there is suicide alertness. How do I know if someone in my life is having thoughts of suicide? How do I find out? How do I connect them with someone who can provide support? And then the third piece, which is suicide intervention, is what do I do if someone is having thoughts of suicide? How do I provide that care, that life-saving care? And often those things get mixed up, and they're really three very different and distinct issues. And that's, I think, I know you asked for two, and I gave you three. But
from what I remember, there were two aspects. There was, how do we help the people who may be suffering from thoughts? And then how do we address the community to be more aware? And I remember just telling somebody at Chul that I'm going to cover this topic. And the response was, why would we talk about this? Because suicide usually promotes suicide. And we want to have lack of conversation around it to prevent it. So I'm just going to throw that out to you.
Yeah. So there's a few things there I want to talk about. And I appreciate that. So I want to start by talking about why it is important to talk about suicide. And the reason why is because suicide, what we understand now based on the study of suicide, which is called suicidology, the research that's been done around suicide, is that having thoughts of suicide is a part of the human experience. We estimate about one in every 20 people is going to have thoughts of suicide within the last year. Now, very often, for those of us who may not be having those thoughts, our awareness of suicide is someone who died of suicide. And that's really just the tip of the iceberg, because for every person who died by suicide, there are many more who are engaging in what we call suicide behavior. So that may be something that's meant to kill themselves. It may be something that's meant to try and end their life, or it may be something less intense than that. And then for every person who's engaging in suicide behavior, there are many more times that of people who are thinking about suicide. And they may think about it in a way that we call active suicidal ideation. I want to die. I want my life to end. Or it may be passive suicidal ideation. I wonder what it would be like if my life were to end. I wonder if I were to die, then that would be okay. I wish I could die. Those would be more passive forms of suicidal ideation, but all of those are suicide thoughts, and we should be paying attention to all of them. I want to pause here, though, for a moment.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
But I just want to make sure that...
No, I want you to remember.
Yeah, I want to just pause here for a moment, since we started to talk about suicide in a more intense way. The point that someone brought up with you is an important one, which is we don't want talking about suicide to put anyone at risk, and it won't, and we'll talk about why that is in a moment. It's important for people to know what supports are out there for them. So if someone is listening to this and it's intensifying their own thoughts of suicide, it's important that they think about what are the resources that they have available to provide support. And so in the United States and Canada, that would be the 988 Lifeline. So people can call or text 988 from anywhere in the United States or Canada, and they will be connected with a professional who can provide support. There's also other resources that we'll post, hopefully together with this, for people in other countries there are suicide lifelines available all throughout the world. We want to make sure that people have the support that's available and local to them and that's meaningful to them. Mudu has a crisis line, and that's specific for the Frum community as well. And so we want to make sure as we're talking about this, most people who will hear this are not going to be affected in that way. But if there is anyone who's hearing this and it's intensifying their own thoughts of suicide, we want you to make sure that you get that support and that help. And so 988 for those in the United States and Canada is the quickest and most available for most people.
You said it's very common to have thoughts. And a thought I've had since I was little, I remember a second grader dying, maybe I was in fifth grade, and just the thought was being, it's so cool, or that person is so cool, because now he gets to see the whole world, know all the answers. Like, he skipped five grades, you know, like that concept. And that's still a thought I have. I remember on October 7th thinking, everyone who got killed, well, and this is terrible, they're not in the suffering that we're all in now. I mean, the hostages have it the worst, the family of the hostages. The people with the loss and the pain are the ones suffering. They're the ones who got out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's, and that's important, because there's this fear about talking about suicide. And what we need to know in
blushing, because I don't think of myself as someone who has these thoughts, but as you were speaking about it, this memory came up.
Right. And so that might be an example of what we would call a very passive form of suicidal ideation. Now, suicide thoughts are not dangerous. Suicide thoughts without having awareness of supports can be very dangerous. And that's really where we can make all the difference. We can't eliminate the possibility that someone might think about suicide. And we maybe shouldn't even try to eliminate the possibility that someone might think about suicide. What we should do is make sure that everyone who has thoughts of suicide knows where they can turn to for meaningful support. And it's for that reason that talking about suicide is so important. Because in a community where talk about suicide is shut down, is quieted, is taboo, the person who's having that thoughts is going to feel very alone. They're going to feel reluctant to share that with anyone else, because maybe someone will be upset with them. Maybe someone won't believe them. Maybe someone will criticize them. And so it becomes harder for them to open up and talk about that. When we have a society where suicide is talked about openly, anyone who has that thought will know, this is something I can share with the person that's most meaningful to me. Maybe it's my sister. Maybe it's my father. Maybe it's my neighbor. Maybe it's my rabbi. Maybe it's my therapist. There's an assumption that comes up sometimes that we think, oh, if someone's having thoughts of suicide, they should share it with a mental health professional. And there's two reasons why that is misleading. The first one is that very often mental health professionals don't have training for suicide intervention. I know that until I did assist training, what I had been trained as a mental health professional is, if someone talks about suicide, you send them to the hospital. One of the ironies that I've confronted in my work, I do training with police officers. Like I said, I do training with nurses. There's a local nursing school that brings me in every year to do a day-long seminar for the nurses about suicide. I do training with doctors, and I do training with mental health professionals. And what happens too often is, when someone has thoughts of suicide and they're willing to open up about it to someone in their life, that person sends them to a mental health professional. The mental health professional calls 911. 911 takes them to a hospital. The nurse in the hospital calls down a resident from the psych floor or the ER resident. None of those people has ever received any suicide intervention training. And so what ends up happening is they're provided with medical care that stabilizes them. Maybe they'll be given a chemical restraint or something that will stabilize them. But it doesn't address the suicide thoughts until they come in contact with someone who is trained to do suicide intervention. The focus is on safety, which it should be. But imagine what that feels like for the person with those thoughts. They've opened up, and now they get passed around to a bunch of different people who aren't who mean well and who want to provide help, but don't necessarily have those tools. And that's why training people in suicide intervention is something I'm so passionate about. I think it's something that we need to do a lot more of in the world of from mental health, making sure that from mental health professionals are better trained, because we want to make sure that when someone has those thoughts, that they can come in contact with someone who can help address those in a healthy way. The other reason why that assumption of going to the mental health professional is the best choice, the other reason why that's problematic, is what people with thoughts of suicide tell us is they want to open up. Sometimes they want to open up to their mental health professional, but sometimes they want to open up to their family member or their friend. That's the person that they feel most comfortable talking about it with. And so what we want to do ideally is create a world where everybody talks about suicide, where suicide is discussed in the open, so that anyone with thoughts can open up. And then that the people they open up to, not every person needs to be a suicide interventionist, but every person should know how to connect them with support. And in this case, for example, by calling or texting 988, they will immediately be in contact with someone who has that training to do suicide intervention and to provide that life-saving care.
Okay, so besides for telling someone who's sharing this part of themselves with you to call 988 or Amudim, what other words or language can you give them? Besides for being a blank page and being scared to say anything wrong?
So I think number one is we need to more openly discuss suicide. The fear that talking about suicide will plant the thoughts in someone's mind is not supported by data. People don't become more suicidal because we talk about suicide. Now, when we talk about suicide, we need to be careful about it. And that's something that you brought up. So we know there's a lot of research in terms of media coverage of suicides. And if you pay attention to the way suicides are covered in the news, you'll notice that especially in the last couple of years, they're much more careful about the language they use. And they're much more careful about not romanticizing suicide. So we want to be careful that anytime we talk about suicide, that we also provide supports. And that's what we did earlier by telling people about 988 and other suicide lifelines and suicide supports. We also want to make sure that we're not romanticizing suicide in the way it's talked about.
What's romanticizing suicide?
So romanticizing suicide is talking about it in a way that makes it desirable, that talks about this person ended their pain through suicide, or
it's
things like that.
Sharing the details.
Absolutely. Sharing, it's also, absolutely. That's another aspect that comes up in the research about the way media covers suicide, is we don't want to sensationalize it by getting too far into the details either. So we want to talk about it in a way that talks about, this is someone who was perhaps feeling very lonely, who was perhaps feeling very, very much in pain, and they died by suicide. Talking about it in those terms, and then making sure that everyone who's listening knows, if you're having these thoughts, there are supports available to address that pain that you're experiencing. When we interview people who survive suicide attempts, there's some really interesting research that was done with individuals who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. The Golden Gate Bridge has historically been a place that a lot of people go to suicide. And there's an excellent speaker named Kevin Hines who is one of the few people who survived jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. And the story he tells, and it's something we hear a lot from other people who survived that same experience or other experiences of suicide, is that the moment after they jumped off or did the suicide behavior or whatever, it doesn't feel like relief. They immediately regret doing what they do. They do that because they don't feel like there's any other way to alleviate their pain, to alleviate their loneliness, to alleviate their hopelessness or helplessness. And so they feel almost pushed into this. And that's where we want to make sure that people have those supports, so they know that they're not alone, that having thoughts of suicide is, again, a relatively normal part of the human experience. And we want to make sure people know that there are supports available out there, that the people in their life can listen. So what do you do if you are concerned that someone in your life might be thinking about suicide? So the first thing is, it's important to ask them directly about suicide. Are you thinking about suicide? Are you thinking about killing yourself? And asking that question is important for two reasons. It's important, first of all, because it communicates to the person that you're brave enough to talk to them about whatever it is they're feeling, that whatever they're going to tell you is something that you can handle and that you won't be upset with them, you won't blame them, you won't dismiss or avoid what they're telling you. And second of all, it's important because it's going to provide information. They might say, yes, I'm thinking about suicide, or they might say, no, I'm not. Therefore, it's important that we ask the question directly. So if we ask someone a question like, are you thinking of harming yourself? That's not a question about suicide, because there are people who harm themselves that don't want to die. And there are people who want to die that don't see it as harming themselves. They see it as alleviating their pain, their loneliness, their hopelessness, their helplessness. And so if we don't ask directly, are you thinking about killing yourself? Are you thinking about suicide? We're not going to get the information we need from the answer. We also need to be careful that the way we ask it communicates that we're ready to hear what they have to say. That we're not, you know, if we ask a question like, you're not going to do something stupid, or say, you're not going to, like, you know, and use like a emotion to indicate that. What they might hear then is you're hesitant to talk about this. And so they, in order to protect you, may not be as open with you. When I used to do child abuse prevention work, one of the really interesting things that shows up in the research there is that many children who experience sexual abuse do not tell any adults because they are worried that the adults will be impacted by hearing that. So they want to protect the adults. That same thing happens in suicide as well, where people sometimes don't tell anyone because they're not sure that you can handle it. So if you have someone in your life that you think might be thinking about suicide, it's important to ask them that question directly. Are you thinking about suicide? Are you thinking about killing yourself? In a way that they will know that you're prepared to hear the answer. And then if they say yes, or if their answer indicates that they are, that's where you're going to put them in contact with 988 or Amudim or other resources, perhaps going to the hospital, but putting them in contact with a professional who will be able to take it from there.
Okay, so I know it's a little bit disrespectful, but if you had to tell us what the gist of the training is that all these people who studied so many years and have their mental health licenses to be therapists don't have the training, what are the crucial aspects that you know, the doctors are missing and police is missing?
And that's an important point. So I think what's important to realize is that none of the trainings that I do are specifically for professionals. And the reason for that is because, as we said, professionals are not the only people that hear about suicide. Professionals need to have those tools, but so do lots of other people. And so when we do suicide training, we really emphasize that when professionals are using these tools, it may not be in their professional capacity. Sometimes professionals are using these tools in their capacity as a parent or as a sibling or as a friend or as a neighbor or as a stranger in the grocery store. And what we want to make sure that everyone knows is that talking about suicide openly and the way we talk about it is important. So that's kind of the first piece, is creating a society where suicide is discussed in the open. And that also has to do with the language we use. So you may have picked up that I use suicide as a verb. I talk about people suiciding and suicided and someone dying by suicide. The reason I do that, and I try not to use terms like committed suicide or attempted suicide, is that that type of language has a lot of stigma attached to it. If we talk about someone attempting suicide and they failed, it sounds like them being alive was a failure. Or if we talk about someone committing suicide, it sounds like something they did that was wrong. And even though it's a much more complicated question on a religious level about how we understand suicide, but someone who's in so much pain that they're suiciding or doing suicide behaviors, we don't want to communicate to them that we see them as being bad for having those thoughts, or that we see them as being bad for what they did. We want them to know that we're accepting and healing, and that's really the key. And so
that's the loophole that gets them buried in Jewish cemeteries, because the first thing you mentioned about having that regret, that information you got from survivors. And the second thing is, it's happening to them. It's not their fault.
The halacha question of how do we approach suicide in today's day and age is much more complicated than anything I can address. But I think that what's important is the way we communicate with people, be intentional. And so I wanna even go back to something you mentioned earlier, Francisco, that I want to come back to, because it's a great example of a well-meaning thing that we may not even realize how that can get to. And you talked earlier about people who are suffering. I don't remember if you said suffering from suicidal thoughts or suffering from mental illness. And even that word, certainly people who are thinking about suicide are experiencing suffering. And people who experience mental illness, there can be a lot of suffering associated with that too. But that's not the only thing they feel, right? Sometimes people feel relief. Sometimes they might even feel joy about suicide. You know, it feels to them like they found a way out or a way to resolve issues. We need to recognize that people experience suicide thoughts. Even that little language change really communicates to people that we understand that this is part of that large range of emotions that they have. People who have depression often feel like they're suffering, but they also often feel bored, and they often feel angry, and all those other emotions that anyone feels. And so the language we use is important. So that's one piece of the training that I think is probably universal across any suicide training that I do. When I talk about suicide alertness, and this is the Safe Talk training, we really focus on helping people notice what we call invitations. So the other part of that research, when we speak to people who have survived suicide, they say that they tried to tell people that they were thinking about suicide. And that can sometimes be a hard thing to hear, especially for people who have loved ones in their life that died by suicide, because it can feel like, no, I knew this person. They never told anyone. But going back to that example of Kevin Hines, Kevin tells the story about how that morning he woke up and his dad said to him, "How are you doing?" And he said, "I'm fine." And his dad even questioned, he said, "Something, it feels like something's going on." And Kevin said, "No, I'm fine. Don't worry about it." And then Kevin went out to the Golden Gate Bridge and he stood on the bridge looking out at the water. And he talks about how he was feeling in that moment all alone, like no one could see what he was suffering through. And then someone tapped him on the shoulder and there was a moment of hope. And he turned around and the person said, "Hey, can you take a picture of me and my friend?" And the thought that went through his mind in that moment was, see, no one understands what I'm going through. And that's where he went over. Now, for Kevin, he wasn't ready to talk to his dad about it, even though his dad reached out to him. He was hoping a stranger would notice. And to him, by looking over in the water, that was the way he was communicating to strangers, "Hey, I'm in pain here. Can someone please reach out and connect with me?" That person who asked him to take the picture, there's no way they could have known that. But it's a reminder that we need to be more attentive and more attuned to things that might be an invitation. And we call it an invitation because the person is saying, "Will you please connect with me? Will you please talk to me about my suicide thoughts and what my experience is like?" And so in Safe Talk training, we focus on understanding those invitations, asking directly about suicide, because it sounds pretty simple and straightforward, but it can be really, really hard to ask someone directly about suicide, and then connect them with life-saving help. And so that's what we do in that half-day suicide alertness training, is how do we identify invitations? How do we ask directly? How do we connect them with what we call keep safe connections? And then how do we make sure that we're not missing, dismissing, or avoiding those signs, that we're being nosy in a helpful way? So that's suicide, that's Safe Talk. And then ASSIST, which is a 2-day suicide intervention training, is much more intense than in that training, we really go into more depth about understanding the experience of having thoughts of suicide, understanding people's attitudes about suicide. And then we talk about the importance of listening to people and connecting with them. Because the key is, with people who are having thoughts of suicide are looking for that connection. They're looking for someone to connect with them. And sometimes those thoughts of suicide make them feel even more isolated and more alone, because they feel like, I'm the only one who's thinking like this, or I can't talk to anybody about what I'm really feeling. When we can open that communication and really listen to people, hear their story about suicide, it actually allows them to connect with the part of the equation that is seeking life. Because no one in any decision is ever completely on one side, right? We always have this ambivalence or this balance or this back and forth between, you know, am I going to have pizza for lunch, or am I going to have, you know, something else for lunch? Am I going to go to exercise, or am I going to stay in bed? Am I going to, whatever decisions we make, there's always this back and forth. And that's true for suicide as well. And that back and forth is really about the person thinking, can I survive with all this pain, or do I need to end it? It's not that they want, and this may be a distinction when we think about it in the halachic frame, between someone who's suiciding because they want to die, because they think death is glorified, which is something that existed at one time in history, and what we see much more commonly today, which is someone feels like they have no other choice, but that they can't survive in any other way. They can't live with that pain. So if someone is feeling that back and forth, one part of them is connected with life, one part of them can't tolerate the pain, the loneliness, the helplessness, the hopelessness, we want to help them connect with the part of themselves that is still connected with life. And that's what ASSIST trains people to do, is through listening and connecting, the person can connect with life themselves. And then once they've realized their life connection, then you can talk about the practical planning. How do you keep yourself safe? What was your suicide plan? What can we do in the meantime to keep you safe? You know, how can, again, whether it's calling 988, other supports, it's important for that person to have their plan that's going to keep them safe for now. Because the real secret in all of this is the person doesn't have to commit to safety forever. It's about getting through this moment. And so safety for now is the key. And that's what we talk about in much more detail in ASSIST training.
The way you describe a lot of this tension and thought process is that as the outsider, instead of trying to contain whatever this is, a box, a balloon, or I don't know if that's the job. It's not the job, I'm assuming, of the person who's being invited to this conversation. But you want to get to the source. You almost want to remove the need or the desire for suicide instead of removing the knives or, you know, whatever it is that may be the safety issue.
Yeah. So harm reduction is important when it comes to suicide. So we want to make sure that if someone's thinking about suicide, that they don't have access to firearms, for example. One of the really alarming statistics that we see in suicide is that when people attempt suicide with a gun, they're much more likely to die. And so we want to, so gun safety, this is something I talk about when I train police officers. One of the things we talk about is the number one cause of death for law enforcement in this country is not dying in the line of duty. The number one cause of death for law enforcement in this country is suicide. The same is true when we think about veterans. More veterans have died from suicide than have died in combat in the last 20 years. A lot of that has to do with gun safety, making sure that if someone's having thoughts about suicide, that we're thoughtful about their access to firearms, that we put as many steps in between the immediate impulse and doing something that could be really dangerous. So we definitely want to think about safety in that way. But you use the example, and I also want to say, in terms of support, it's important for the person who is the caregiver, right? The family member, the loved one, the friend, the mental health professional, that they take care of themselves and that they provide, that they know what their own limits are and what's safe for them. And also that after talking with someone who has thoughts of suicide, that they seek that support themselves. I know when I do assist training, I have a routine that I do that's about self-care. I need to laugh after, like it's a 2-day training. The night in between the two trainings, I need to do something that will make me laugh. I need to spend time with my kids. It's how I connect. So knowing how you seek your own support is critical in being supportive to others. But you use that the balloon metaphor, and that makes me think you might have been through one of these trainings, because we actually use that balloon metaphor to talk about what it's like for the person with thoughts. It can feel like that pressure is building up and building up and building up and is about to burst. And then it kind of rises up in a way where maybe they're, you know, just kind of sticking up above the surface to see, is anyone going to see me? Is anyone going to see that I'm what I'm going through? So that balloon is very important. We don't want to pop the balloon, which would be like getting rid of those thoughts. We want to support the person. We want to make sure that they're connect, that they're listened, that they're heard, that they feel connected, and that they are able to connect with safety. And that's really the shift in mindset. Again, when I talk to law enforcement, that's really what we focus on, is when someone's having thoughts about suicide, it's not about fixing, or it's about listening to them and helping them feel supported. In terms of thinking about fixing things, that's another thing that comes up. Sometimes someone will say, you know, whatever it is, I just lost my job, and therefore, you know, I don't know how I'm going to meet my mortgage payment, so I'm thinking about suicide. And hearing that, a person may say, you know, that's an easy thing to fix. I have some extra money in savings, or I can connect you with this asset organization. And that can seem like a solution. But we need to realize that in that moment, when the person's having thoughts of suicide, it's about suicide. And what they need right then is to feel connected and listened to about those thoughts of suicide, about how lonely that feels and how painful that feels. Sometimes by fixing the problem, we can make them feel not heard. Because, okay, fine, that gets me through this month, but what about next month? That's why listening is so important. And then once they feel listened to and connected, and they are connected with life, then we can work on, how do we make sure that you're safe? How do we make sure that there's a roof over your head, that your children are taken care of, that you can have meaning in your life? All those things are important after the person feels listened to about their thoughts of suicide and connected.
I listened to a podcast with David Reedman on Freakonomics. He researches school shootings. And what one of the things he said was, the person who's, and that's another one, murder by suicide, when somebody's, and I'm sure that's its own case, but that person each time was trying to be stopped, and they left breadcrumbs for anyone to find them, to stop them. He even shared one of the notes one of those shooters left was saying, if someone just told me to stop or took my gun away, I wouldn't do it. And no one stopped them. And there are usually many, many breadcrumbs left. It's not just one. And they're just trying to find that. I'll use this word because I think about it with self-harm and thoughts of suicide, which you differentiated those two ideas. There's this aspect of attention. An example could be using it as a threat to somebody else. And essentially, when you're saying they need to be connected to, you need to address the thoughts of suicide, not the problem that they might need fixing, that's addressing the need for attention.
Yeah. So I want to talk about that word attention, because that's something, as a professional, I'll see that written on someone's evaluation, the person's engaging in attention-seeking behaviors. And for me, that always feels very frustrating, because if someone wants attention, they can, you know, put on a perm costume and go into the middle of the street. There are safer and easier ways for someone to get attention. What people are seeking is connection. And that's something different. What people are seeking is they feel so alone, so desperate, so misunderstood that they want someone to connect, to understand them. And when we see that, then we're able to provide that connection in a healthy way. That is what provides that healing. As opposed to if someone's engaging in attention-seeking behaviors, it may make sense, well, I'm not going to feed into their attention-seeking behavior. Anytime someone talks about suicide, it should be paid attention to. It should be taken seriously. We should never dismiss thoughts of suicide, but we should also do it in a safe way. So whether it's calling Hatzalah or calling 988 or calling Amudim, we want to connect with them. When we notice that someone's having those thoughts, we want to connect them with a professional who can do some of those assessment tools to figure out what are their needs right now. But we should never think about dismissing it, oh, because it's just attention-seeking behavior. In terms of what you mentioned with school shooters and murder by suicide, that's a little different topic. There's someone named Malloy who's done some really interesting work in terms of understanding school shooters. But part of why that's a different thing is it's so much more rare than suicide is. Suicide is something that's much more common, but there are similarities. So I'm just going to share a few years ago here in Michigan, here in Oakland County, we had the school shooting at Oxford High School. And I was part of the team that provided crisis support for a few months after that in the school, in Oxford High School and in the community. And a little while after that, we were doing a Safe Talk training, suicide alertness, and we were emphasizing the importance of asking directly about suicide. And there were two women in the training who kept pushing back. Can you really ask someone directly about suicide? What if they're a child? You don't want to plant the ideas in their head. And we went over the same things that we talked about how talking about suicide doesn't plant the idea in their head, that asking about suicide allows them to talk about it openly. But they clearly were very uncomfortable. And they kept asking those questions over and over again. What if the parents are going to be upset that you ask them about suicide? What if you ask it in a more indirect way, just to see what they might be thinking? And towards the end of the training, I will admit, I was feeling a little bit frustrated with how they weren't accepting their responses. And so I said to them, it occurs to me that we're sitting here in the room where we have to be giving the training. We were about 20 miles south of Oxford High School, and it was just a few months separated from that incident. And for those who followed that incident, the shooter, Ethan Crumbly, was someone who was sending those invitations pretty clearly over and over and over again that there was something going on in his life that he was looking for support. And unfortunately, nobody asked those questions in the right way. His mother was just convicted of manslaughter because the jury determined that she wasn't responding in the right way to that. But there were lots of people in his life who weren't picking up. And I said, imagine if someone had asked him directly, Ethan, what you know, are you thinking about suicide? Are you thinking about killing yourself? Are you thinking about killing other people? And he felt like he could talk openly with someone about that. You know, imagine if that had happened. And the two women sitting in the training said to me, oh, that was, yeah, we're teachers in Oxford. And so they were, what that really brought home to me is that for them, it wasn't, you know, there wasn't any blame there. The culture that they were operating in told them, don't talk about suicide, don't ask about suicide. And that culture creates that danger. I don't know what could have happened or what would have happened in that particular instance, but we do know that when suicide is talked about openly, when people are asked directly about suicide, it does provide safety on a community level and on an individual level so that people are able to connect with their own feeling, their own connection with life, and connect with resources that can be supportive.
Thank you for addressing that. One thing that you mentioned earlier, and I would like to go into that a little deeper, the self-harming behaviors versus drugs, eating disorders, cigarettes. I don't know if we could put cigarettes in that, maybe for somebody with lung cancer. Yeah. If you have some more examples of self-harming
Yeah. So when we think about self-harming behaviors, it could be someone who's cutting themselves. It could be someone who's engaging in substance use. It could be someone who is not eating properly. And sometimes those behaviors are that person sending out invitations about suicide. They're communicating, hey, I don't feel like my life is worth living. Can someone please pay attention to that? That can be the case. Sometimes those behaviors provide relief in other ways. They could be trauma-based. They could be people sometimes engage in self-harm behavior because it helps them feel a sense of control in their life. And sometimes it's addiction-based. Sometimes it's meeting some other need. The only way we can know that is by asking directly. So saying to someone, hey, I noticed that lately you've stopped eating like you used to. And sometimes when people do that, they're thinking about suicide. Have you been thinking about killing yourself? That can be an important question to ask. And they might say, yes, I have. Or they might say, no, I just, you know, I'm trying to lose some weight. Or they might say, I'm a disgusting person and I just want to be. And each of those answers will help connect them with the proper support, whether they need an eating disorder specialist, whether they need a mental health professional who can treat self-harm behaviors, whether they need an addiction professional, or whether they need a suicide intervention. Once we know what's going on by talking to them in an honest and open way, then we can connect them with the proper resource. But that's important to know the distinction is that, is this self-harm behavior about an invitation to talk about suicide? Is it about trying to feel more control or more acceptance in their life? Is it about a trauma response? Is it about addiction? And those are things that can only be determined by having those conversations and talking openly about them, because that's really the key. The more people feel like they can talk and connect with others, the more these things they're feeling, which they don't want to feel, are things that can be accepted and met with empathy rather than judgment and rejection and stigma, the more we're going to be able to provide people with support through that moment so that they can live their best life.
On a personal note, I'd like to ask you, do you feel a sense of accomplishment when you provide that support to somebody? Or is it like they're never really safe? Once you're down a certain road, you're at risk for the rest of your life. And on the flip side, have you lost patients, clients, and how have you dealt with that personally?
So that's a powerful question. Something we talk about all the time when we talk about suicide intervention is, if you provide a life-saving suicide intervention and then the person attempts again, that's not a failure. That's a success. Just like if someone falls down and injures themselves and that injury heals and then they fall down another time, that doesn't mean the original intervention wasn't effective. The purpose of an intervention is to keep someone safe for now. And so if we kept them safe for now, even if ultimately they die or they attempt again, those are successes. And so we need to remember that. If someone dies after you provide support, that feels really, really hard. And that's, again, where it's important for a person to seek out their own support and to go through their own grief and their own trauma and their secondary trauma. I know that for me, when there's a moment at the end of every training that I do where the training is over and I thank people for coming and for their attention. And I always say this, and it's something that I really feel deeply, especially in that moment. And it's such a powerful feeling. And I say, I'm just thinking about all the people out there who, before this training started, did not have access to someone who could help them. And now, after these 2 days or these 4 hours or these 2 hours or however much time we spent together, this community that we live in is a safer place because there are this many more people who can provide that support. And it's why I think it's so important in our community, in the FRM community, that we talk more about suicide, that we prepare more to be, as mental health professionals, as Rabbanim, Hatzalah, community members, whatever role we see ourselves in, if we can have more people in the community that are trained and assist in safe talk or other ASMR, other suicide interventions, if we can be more prepared, how many lives can we save? How many people can we feel less, can we make sure that they're feeling less lonely? I think that's really the power and why it's so wonderful and so incredible that you're doing this work, because as long as we continue to think about suicide as this very rare anomaly, and hopefully it is in terms of people dying from suicide, but thoughts of suicide are not. And those people who are in all of our lives who are thinking about suicide, we want them not to feel so lonely, not to feel so isolated. By having this conversation openly, it's really important. I made the comparison before to child abuse prevention. I was just thinking about, I remember when we did Safety Kid, which is a child abuse prevention program by Debbie Fox.
We covered that on this podcast.
Yeah, we did that here in Detroit. And I remember at the time we were putting up signs about the event. And there were some people who pushed back and said, maybe these signs shouldn't be in public. This is something that should be more quiet. And I asked our Das Torah about that. And what he told me was something very powerful. He said, if someone walks into Shul and sees that sign up that says the community is coming together on this date at this time in this place to talk about child abuse, and that person feels a little bit of terror in their heart, it's worth the whole thing just for that. So I want to flip that on the other side. If by doing this podcast, there's someone out there who says, maybe I'm not so different. Maybe there's someone out there who can talk to me about my suicide thoughts. Maybe there are other people in my life who are also having suicide thoughts or who have dealt with that in the past. And I can call 988 or I can text 988 or I can reach out to Amudim or one of the other resources, or I can talk to my friend or my mother or my, you know, if just for that person alone, it's so worthwhile. And knowing that there are people listening to this who are going to have that experience, that is so incredibly important. So thank you so much for being brave enough to talk about this topic.
I'm not done. I have one more thing before we end. We did not address the people who've lost their loved ones or people they know. And I would like if you can say a few words for them, because they live in their own world of misery.
So losing someone to suicide is really, really painful. And it's important for people to know that it's not their fault. All of these tools that I've talked about are tools that were developed by people who either experienced suicide thoughts themselves or had someone close to them that died by suicide. And so what they did from that is they learned from those experiences and thought, how can we save someone else's life? That's what worked for them. Every person's going to deal with their grief and their trauma in another way. For someone who has them experience the suicide with someone close to them, you can reach out to suicide survivor groups. Living Works, which developed the Safe Talk and Assist, they also have a program called Suicide to Hope, which is training therapists to provide that particular support. But people can reach out to suicide survivor groups and
for the family.
Yeah, and we can put those resources also up to help connect people with some of those organizations and communities that exist around dealing with that particular type of loss. It can be really, really painful and really traumatic.
Whatever you send me, all the links, we'll link it in the show notes. And shout out to your wife who listens to the podcast. Sarah, thank you for listening. Thank you so much for doing this episode with me. I really appreciate your time. You do incredible work. So I hope you have lots of atzlacha.
Thank you.
I hope you learned a lot from this episode. And if you did, I'd love to hear your feedback. I'd love to hear from you, as always. Check out the other podcasts on the Jewish Coffee House Network. See you next time.